on the book of 1 Peter. Dave was teaching this class, and he's had some health issues, and I was scheduled to pick up after him. So last week I started, and we started going through the book of 1 Peter. And last week, basically, we got the book introduced, and I think we probably got through about verse 3. Let me get over there. But we were going through the book of 1 Peter, and we pointed out that basically it's a book about trials. The people are facing persecution and suffering, and it's a book that Peter wrote to encourage them to endure through those trials and through those tribulations. Last week, I believe we got down to verse 3. We did the introduction, and we got down to verse 3, and we left off there. Verse 3 says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead." We just basically introduced that last week. But there's three things that are evident here concerning the new birth that Peter mentions. Number one, it's brought about by the Father as a result of his great mercy. Number two, it provides for a living hope, which we will get to here in a minute. And thirdly, it is accomplished as a result of Christ's conquering of death in his resurrection. So the idea here, he speaks about here is about being born again. Okay, being born again. Okay, now, in our culture today, when a person has a sudden change in life, in Christian terms, in the church, we refer to it as being born again. People in the world, what do they refer to it as being? Sometimes that's good. How about turning over a new leaf? But in most cases, in order for a person to turn over a new leaf, they have to go through a drastic change. And I don't know if anybody here is a fan of Harrison Ford, but a few years ago, he had a movie out, and he played an attorney by the name of Henry Turner. And he was an attorney who would do anything he had to do to win a case. He was unscrupulous. He was out to win at any cost. And one night as he leaves his office, he's on the way home and he stops at a convenience store. And he walks into a holdup. And he's shot in the chest and he's also shot in the head. And naturally he's rushed to the hospital and all that. And supposedly on the operating table in the emergency room, he dies and he's brought back to life. Well, supposedly after he's brought back to life, he has a new birth or turns over a new leaf. And he can't remember his past, but his life is completely transformed. Okay, it's just like he's a new person. It's like he's reborn. And anyway, he reaches the point that he despises the old life he had, and he becomes a man of character. He's a better man for his family and everything else. And it seems that even Hollywood in this film understood something very important. How do you completely transform a person's life? You kill him and bring him back from the dead. Now, turn over to the book of Romans, if you would, chapter 6, verses 3 through 6. Romans chapter 6, verses 3 through 6. Ron Mitchell, would you read that for us?
Romans 6, 3 through 6.
Please. So Paul points out there when we're converted or when we're baptized, when we go down into the waters, we experience the death of Christ. When we come up, we're born again and we experience a new life in Christ. So we're born again. And that's what Peter speaks about here, how that we're born again. But notice what he says about this being born again. What does he say about it? He says that we're born again to what? A living hope. You're born again to a living hope from the resurrection of the dead. Now, when we speak about hope, is there a difference between a living hope and a dead hope? Is all hope real? Now, I could say tomorrow I expect to receive, I hope that I will receive a $3 or $4 million check from some rich person who sends it. That's hope. But it would not be a living hope because I don't know anybody's got that kind of money. If they did have it, they wouldn't give it to me. Now, I could also say tomorrow morning, I hope that I will receive X amount of dollars because I'm expecting an income tax check refund. In that case, if I've made the steps and I haven't filled out an income tax, I have a right to hope for that income tax. So hope has to be a living hope. Now, I'd like to give a little bit of a background on hope in the ancient world. Sophocles wrote, quote, "Not to be born at all, that is by far the best fortune. The second best is as soon as one is born, with all speed to return thither whence one has come." When people give up hope, what happens to them? We hear about people committing suicide. In most cases, why do they do that? There's someone who have, for whatever reason, they have completely given up hope. Okay, here a few years ago, there was a famous Canadian ambassador to Egypt. He was found dead. He was an authority on Egyptian culture and stuff like that. Really well respected in the political community and all that, and he took his own life. And he left a note in his shirt pocket that read the following way. "I have no option. I kill myself because I live without hope." It's difficult in life sometimes, you know, to get through life, and you have to have hope or something to look forward to survive in life. There's a well-known Israeli psychologist named Shlomo Benitez. And anyway, he conducted a study showing the parts that hope plays in helping people recover from illness, surviving disaster, and coping with stress. He claims that hope is an active process in which one imagines a positive future based on realistic assessment of the present. Dr. Benitez lists four styles of response to trouble when we go through them. First of all, he says he mentions hope based on reality. And he says that is the best way and the most effective method of managing problems is a hope that's based on reality. Second of all, he mentions that hope plus denial, which rests on delusion. This results many times with a denier falling apart when he's faced with bad news. So that's not such a good idea. Then thirdly, he mentions total denial. This is when a person blots out difficulty totally. This is at the least a vital psychological sign. It shows that the person is still fighting. Then fourthly, he says giving up. This indicates neither hoping nor denying and has the poorest prognosis. So I would say most people who probably take their own lives are without hope and they simply give up. And I've mentioned this before, but I will mention it again. There's a book I have in my library by a psychiatrist, a Jewish psychiatrist called Dr. Viktor Frankl. It's called Man's Search for Meaning. And he survived, he was a Jewish psychiatrist, and he survived the Holocaust. And he developed a whole type of psychology and psychotherapy based on what he learned in those concentration camps. And I mean, he experienced suffering and saw suffering among other people that you cannot even begin to imagine. He came to the conclusion that as long as a person has a reason or a purpose or something to look forward to, that they could endure anything that they went through. Basically, it was based on hope. If people had hope in something better at some future date, regardless of what they were going through at the present time, they could endure it. And he claims that in the concentration camp that he was in several different ones, but he claimed that the concentration camp that he was in, that there was rumors, they were always getting rumors that they were going to be liberated. And he heard that they were getting outside information and all that between Christmas and New Year's, I forget which year it was, that they were going to be liberated. And everybody was anticipating that and looking forward to it. And he says Christmas rolled around, they went through New Year's, and they weren't liberated. And he said in the concentration camp that he was in, there was natural people dying every day from starvation and just the condition, the sanitation and all that. But he said after New Year's rolled around, he said the rate of mortality of people dying just skyrocketed. And he came to the conclusion that they had all been hoping that they would be freed between Christmas and New Year's, and it didn't come about. They gave up hope. They just started dying off in masses. And he attributes that to the loss of hope. Now, let's look at the book of Romans, chapter 15, verse 4. Romans chapter 15, verse 4. I'll let anyone who gets there first read it. Okay, another example. Give you a little bit of history about myself. When I was a kid, I always dreamed of being a pilot. Well, I was lousy at math and couldn't see, and I don't have the temperament for it. I'm too high strung, so that was a dream that never panned out. But when I was right out of high school, about 20 or 21, I worked with a guy named Herman Weiss, and he was a bomber pilot who flew bombing missions over Germany during World War II. And there was days he would start reminiscing and talking about the days that he was a pilot. And the stories just mesmerized me. He claimed that there's days that they would send 1,000 bombers over Germany at the height of the bombing with the Great Britain and U.S. and all the allies. They'd send 1,000 bombers out. He said it was not uncommon for 700 of them to return to the base. And he said that he saw seasoned pilots go out and get into the cockpits of the planes and fire up the engines and be waiting for the clearance to take off. Seasoned pilots sat there and just completely mentally break down because of the stress and pressure. And anyway, it becomes so bad that the military found out, hey, we've got to do something because the amount of losses of these pilots and the stress is just destroying them. So they came up with a plan, and if you go out on the internet and research it, you'll find different numbers. But basically, if they were flying fighting or combat missions, they were only allowed to fly so many missions, and guess what? Then they were given a leave or they were able to go home. And depending on who you read and research, roughly in combat missions, I think it was roughly somewhere around 40. So after each mission they flew, if they survived, guess what? Only 39 more to go. 28 more to go or whatever. So they had hope that eventually it would come to an end. And once they flew all their missions, they were rotated out. Sometimes they would go train people and fly missions that weren't as risky and all that. But anyway, it was based on hope. It gave them something to look forward to, something that was better in the future. Is we're going through trials in life and difficulties. If we don't have something better to look forward to, we become disillusioned, we give up. And Peter here speaks about a hope that's not based on illusion. Instead, it's based on something that we can sink our teeth into. Now, I'd like to point something out. Has anybody here ever heard of a doctor named Dr. Jerome Groopman? He's a medical professor and teaches medicine at Harvard's medical school. And through his career, he diagnosed many, many different people with serious diseases. And he discovered that all of the people that he diagnosed were, quote, looking for a sense of genuine hope. And indeed, that hope was as important to them as anything he might prescribe as a physician. He went on to write a book called The Anatomy of Hope. In this book, Groopman was asked for his definition of hope. He replied, quote, basically, I think hope is the ability to see a path to the future. You're facing dire circumstances and you need to know that everything that's blocking or threatening you, and you can see a path or a potential path to get to where you want to be. Once you see that, there's a tremendous emotional uplift that occurs. The doctor goes on to confess, quote, I think hope has been, is, and always will be the heart of medicine and healing. We could not live without hope. Even with all the medical technology available to us today, we still come back to this profound human need to believe. There is a possibility to reach a future that is better than the one in the present. So Peter here is addressing people, we pointed out last week, they're facing persecution. They're going to undergo all type of suffering. What does he do to encourage them? He reminds them of the new birth they've experienced and the living hope that they have waiting for them at the end. Now, I want to point something out. I think there's many characteristics that sum up Christianity. In 1 Corinthians 13:13, Paul says, but now abides what? Love. In Hebrews 11, verse 6, what does he say? Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Imagine, if you could, a chain And it links all the characteristics of Christianity together. You might have patience out here, and you might have love and so forth. But I believe in that chain, next to each other, directly linked together, would be hope and faith, because they're so much, they're so similar. So Peter mentions here the fact that they need hope to endure the trials. Now notice verse 4. This is powerful. They have a living hope, and it's based on the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. That's verse 3. Now notice verse 4. He begins to talk about to obtain an inheritance which is imperishable, undefiled, and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. What does he say about this inheritance that they have waiting for them in heaven?
It's incorruptible.
What else? You're right. Okay, now, if you look at the actual Greek terminology here, the words that are translated, imperishable, undefiled, and will not fade away. My understanding of them are, this term here, imperishable, is the idea of something that can never be taken away. The term here that is translated undefiled means something that can never be tainted or never be vandalized. Then when he mentions will not fade away, that's the idea there that it's never going to grow old. Now, illustration. Has anybody here ever wanted a new house? Anybody here ever wanted a new car? A special car, that new 4x4 pickup or Jeep or whatever. Okay, now, when you get that, you're looking forward to it. Regardless of what it is, when you get it, there's always the first possibility of what? If the economy goes south, will I be able to make the payments on it? If you can't make the payments, what happens? You lose it. Let's assume that you are able to make the payments and you keep it. Now, I came from El Paso, and down there we used to have a terrible problem with tagging. People come along with spray cans and just put graffiti on stuff and just mess it up. Okay, that's what we would call, what do you call that term for that? Tagging or graffiti or vandalism, okay? Now, if you pay the payments on this house or that car, somebody may come along and tag it with a spray can. They may take a rock and run it down the side of that car, and it's been vandalized, and guess what? It's not what it used to be. But if you keep the payments up on it, and it's never vandalized, guess what? I'll guarantee you in time what happens. You get up and go up there and fire up that car and drive it to work after so many months, what happens? The news is gone. The payments are still there. The news is gone. It just doesn't give you the thrill before. My understanding of what Peter is talking about here in this inheritance we have that is imperishable, undefiled, and will not fade away. It's something that can never be taken away from us. It's never going to be defiled. Can't be vandalized. And thirdly, the new is going to be refreshing. Will never go away. Never go away. And anything we experience in that life, we have to deal with that. Now, speaking about inheritances, I read a story here a while back. It's about a person that lived up in Connecticut. And they had some property and some holdings in Canada. And supposedly the guy that owned it died, and his inheritors or his people who was going to get the property inherited it. And it was basically worth about $26,000. And of course, when he went to Canada to get the money out of Canada to bring it back to the United States, there was all types of taxes and fees and tariffs and everything else. So they took over half of the money in fees and all. Then when he got it into the United States, there was also taxes on that. And supposedly the people that actually got the inheritance ended up having to pay the government money. So that whole inheritance was eaten up. Now, when we start speaking about inheritance in heaven for us, it's not going to be like that. It's something that we can hang our hat on that's real. Okay, so that's the idea that Peter is pointing out here. Now, let's go to Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 21. Matthew 6, verses 19 through 21. Anybody want to volunteer to read that for us as soon as you get there? I'm having a hard time focusing on my notes and turning the pages, so I'll let you guys read.
Thank you. And where thieves do not break in and steal, for where your treasure is, there is there your heart will be also.
Yes, that's it. Now, notice back here in verse 4, 1 Peter, he mentions about this inheritance we have in heaven that is reserved for us. The term there, reserved in heaven, may also be translated guarded. It's a military term which points to the certainty of the inheritance. It's something that's certain that can't be taken away. So he mentions the new birth that's reassured by the, that's guaranteed by the resurrection of Christ from the dead. Then he speaks about the inheritance we have coming. Now, let's look at verses 6 through 9. Here we have the testing of salvation. He will start speaking about the testing that we go through in verses 6 through 9. I'll read those now. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in the praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you have not seen him, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but you believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls. Now, here in verses 6 through 9, he will lay out certain rules or certain things about trials. Okay, we rejoice in the things that Peter has mentioned in the preceding five verses. Okay, in what do we greatly rejoice? We rejoice in the things Peter has mentioned in the preceding five verses. Peter mentions the ministry of God the Father. By his mercy, he chose us in his foreknowledge. Peter mentions the ministry of the Son. We've been sprinkled by his blood. Peter mentions the ministry of the Holy Spirit, how we're sanctified by the Spirit. Now then, in verses 6 through 9, he's going to list three things concerning trials. Does anybody want to venture to say what those three things are? What does he say from the scripture there? Okay. First of all, he says that trials appear in an unlimited variety. Notice various. The Greek word there translated various is poilikos, which literally means many-colored. Okay, now, today we refer to different types of trials as being what? What are some of the trials that we have to go through that we refer to as trials? What are things that we have to endure as trials? Okay, what else?
Illness.
What else?
Old age.
Health. What else? Very good. Domestic problems, raising your family, problems that go with it. How about financial? Let me ask you something. Many times we think of financial trials by loss of a job, economy going south, whatever, where we don't have enough money. We think of that as a trial. Let me ask you this. Do trials ever come in the form of prosperity?
Yes.
Why? You're right, I believe.
I have seen people get promoted, and with that increase in responsibility and money, it ate them alive.
How about someone who has always struggled financially to make ends meet? They've always had to trust God. But then one day an aunt or an uncle or a distant relative or someone dies and they never have to worry about wealth anymore. And what's the temptation there? What's the trial? If they're not careful, they'll start trusting in that money and forget about trusting in God, whom they've always trusted in. Before, I heard a story told about a preacher one time, an older guy, very wise. And anyway, they was a member of the congregation, inherited a bunch of money. The next elders meeting, he says, "Hey, we need to pray for brother so-and-so. He's going to have some trials." And the elder says, "Well, why? He's just inherited all this money." He says, "That's the problem." He says, "I'm afraid that money may become a substitute for God." And we don't think of it that way. We say, "Oh, if I had enough money, I wouldn't have any problems." With that money usually comes more problems many times than it's worth. So trials appear in a limited variety. Let me ask you this. Do trials ever come in the form of people? I've said this before, but it's worth repeating. There was an elder in El Paso, knew, and he says, Walter, he says, everybody that enters your life are a blessing. He says, some of them are a blessing when they come, others are a blessing when they go. And that's true. But just notice what you have to go through sometimes being with people. And you say, it's got to be easier than this, but it's not. And you know what I found out when I was in full-time work, dealing with those in the church, it was really a problem. That's one thing I do not miss. And I'll never forget what Richard Baggett told us one time when we were in school. He says, you know what? You guys are going to get graduated and leave and go out of this place, and they're going to invite you to congregation and try out, and they're going to have a great big potluck and welcome you. And you're going to start. And he says, those people that are so nice to you, he says, they're the very same ones in 6 months going to be wanting to fire you. So, I mean, you have to deal with people. And sometimes we bring it upon ourselves. This idea, though, of trials kind of carries the idea of going against the grain. Our space shuttle, when we shoot them out into outer space and they come back, what is the truth? Yeah, about, oh, Ed.
When I think about trials concerning people, it always brings to my mind when your kids die from the disease.
Yes, absolutely.
That you a lot of heartaches.
Or parents, you don't expect for your kids, you don't expect to outlive your kids. And sometimes that's just not the case. Sometimes you have, you know, you lose them before you die, and you're not prepared for it. Back to this idea of trials and going against the grain and friction and stuff like that. The space shuttles, when we send them into outer space, what is the crucial point in bringing them home?
Re-entry.
What is so crucial about reentry?
Fire.
Well, there's so much friction as they enter the gravitational field, they have to have special heat shields on the wings so it won't burn up. Remember a few years ago down there over Texas when they were coming in and the heat shields came off and it burned up and killed them? They're going against resistance. In life, especially if we're trying to do what God wants us to do, we're going to be going against resistance of the world, and it's going to create friction. It'll create trials. It'll create problems. That's what the people that Peter is writing to are going through. They're going through people who are persecuting them because they're not involved in the same things that we pointed out last week that the people around them were. Now, so trials, first of all, appear in a unlimited variety. Number two, well, before I leave this point, listen to this. There is a fountain that is cold at midday and warm at midnight. So are some Christians, frequently cold in the midday of prosperity and warm in the midnight of adversity. Afflictions are not a consuming but a refining fire to the godly. Let's turn over to James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. James 1, verses 2 through 4. Anybody?
My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience.
Okay. Now, point number two. Trials are of a limited duration. Verse 6, though now for a little while. Excuse me. Okay? Now, when trials come our way and we're going through difficult times, we should say, I am here by God's appointment, in His keeping, under His training, and for His time. Nobody that I know of volunteers to lose their job, volunteers to lose a child, volunteers to have their kids rebel, volunteers to get sick. You know, it happens. So we have to learn to make the most of it. I remember as a kid, I mean, we have to look at these trials through the lens of God and how God can use them. I remember as a kid, I used to love these comic books. And they came out with these kind of comic books, were kind of like 3D. They were kind of blurred. And you put these special glasses on and looked at the comic books, and all of a sudden they became real vivid, real plain. And when we're going through trials, if we don't look at them through the lens of God and what God's doing in our lives through that, they're not going to make sense. We have to trust Him through it. Okay, now, thirdly, trials prepare us for the future coming of Christ. Okay, British journalist Malcolm Muggeridge, he became a Christian before his death. Later in life, he said the following. He says, quote, contrary to what might be expected, I look back on experiences that at the time seemed especially desolating and painful with particular satisfaction. Indeed, everything I have learned, everything that has truly enhanced and enlightened my existence, has been through affliction and not through happiness. But wouldn't it be nice if we could go through life and be happy all the time and get the character development and all that without having to go through those friction, go through the friction and the pain of life? It just doesn't work that way. Now, Peter here mentions in verse 7 that the proof of your faith being more precious than gold. Now, do you guys remember several years ago we went through the book of John? As we were going through the Gospel of John, I pointed out that there are certain words that are characteristics to John's Gospel that he keeps mentioning and bringing up over and over again. In the epistles of 1 and 2 Peter, Peter uses the term precious. It's one of the terms that he uses over and over again. He mentions the precious trial of faith here in 1 Peter 1, verse 7. He mentions the precious living stones, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 4 and 7. He mentions the precious faith, 2 Peter 1, verse 1. And he mentions the precious promises, 2 Peter 1, verse 4. Now let's turn over to Isaiah chapter 48, verse 10. Someone read Isaiah 48, verse 10 for us, please. Okay. Now, look here in verse 7. Look at this term here, proof, that the proof of your faith. The Greek word there for proof is dokozomai. It literally means to put someone to the test with the expectation of showing that he is worthy of being approved. Matter of fact, I'm told from research I've done in the ancient world, the time this was written, in the word dokozimos was used in the New Testament days to describe the final examination all medical students had to pass before they were given a right to practice medicine. So today, if you're going to be a doctor, if you're going to be a lawyer, a CPA, or what must you do? There's something you have to go through to prove that you're worthy of the position. If we're going to go to heaven, there's things we have to go through to get there, okay? Just as an assayer tests the gold to see it is in the... Just as the assayer tests the gold to see if it is pure or counterfeit, so the trials of life test our faith to prove its sincerity. Now, is anybody here familiar with the way the ancient goldsmiths would refine gold? Supposedly, you know, to refine gold, it has to come under intense heat. And anyway, as it comes under intense heat, the impurities would come to the surface. And an assayer or a goldsmith would sit there with fire. He had gold in a pot or something. He would heat it up. And as he heated it up, all of the impurities would float to the top. Then he would take a spoon and dip it out. Then he would look into the gold, and whenever he could see his reflection, he knew that the gold was pure. And as we go through trials, the purpose of it is so that we'll have the representation of the image of Christ and be more like him. It's not an easy thing. And I've also read that's the way they did it in ancient times. I've read currently that when they purify gold, they still do it, but on a larger scale. And believe it or not, during the purifying process, they put it in huge vats. And it takes 4 tons of gold ore to produce 1 ounce of pure gold. Think about that. 4 tons to purify it and get all the waste out of it for 1 ounce of gold. So it's a valuable commodity. So it has to go through a lot, and we have to go through a lot to develop character in our lives to be the type of people God would have us to be. Now, has anyone here ever heard a severe trial that someone is going through, sometimes called an acid test? This term acid test originated during times when gold was widely circulated. Nitric acid was applied to an object of gold to see if it was genuine or not. If it was fake, the acid decomposed it. If it was genuine, the gold was unaffected. So as we go through these lives, these trials and lives, what does it do? It's to build character in us and develop Christ in our life and have his attributes. You guys may have heard of a commentator named Matthew Henry. Very good commentator. I used to have some of his books and all that he wrote. Well, anyway, he was a very simple man, didn't have a whole lot, but very spiritual. And anyway, he always could look at things through the proper perspective. And one day, he was a simple man, kind of poor, and one day someone stole his purse, stole all the money he had. And rather than being down and out, he looked at it this way. He says, he had this to say, he entered this in his journal. He says, first, he was glad, first, because he had never robbed me before. Second, although he took my purse, he didn't take my life. Third, although he took all I possessed, it wasn't much. And fourth, it was I who was robbed and not I who was robbed. And not I who robbed. So he had the proper outlook or the proper perspective. In verse 7 now, Peter mentions three things to describe the outcome of our trials. That'll be ours at the coming of Jesus Christ. What are those three things? Okay, that's the things we will receive. When do we receive those things? At his coming. Now, let me point this out. We live in a society that we want it now. We don't want to wait for anything. Most all of us desire, we like to be praised, we like to receive honor and glory. And when do we like it? Now. When will we receive it? Now, I realize in the world today, as the world operates, a lot of people get it today. But for us, when we receive praise, glory, and honor, it's supposed to be at the return of Jesus Christ when he comes back. So people desire these three things. Peter tells these people they'll receive these things at the second coming of Christ. Now, last week in conclusion, I told a story. I mentioned a guy named Tony Campolo who teaches school on the East, back in Pennsylvania. He's a Baptist and he teaches in a secular school, but he's got several books out and I have them. And he's a very profound thinker. And anyway, in one of his books, he tells the story about when he was in seminary training to be a preacher. And he claims that they had a homiletics class, which is basically a class that teaches you how to prepare sermons and deliver sermons and all of that. And he claims in this class, and when I was in Lubbock, we had to do the same thing. You had to get up in front of the class and deliver a sermon. Everybody evaluated you, including your instructors. But he claimed that in this one particular class that he had to get up, and all of his classmates were there, and his instructor, and he had to get up and give a sermon. And he said he was really prepared. He said it was biblical. He said the points were progressive and fell into place with good illustrations. He said his gestures, his delivery was just perfect. And he said he got up and delivered that sermon and sat down. And he said then he received a whole stack of notes and evaluations from all of his classmates and all. And he said every one of them assured him that he was going to go far as a preacher. And he said his head was just about that big. And he said the very last evaluation he picked up was that of his instructor. And he claims that the instructor wrote on the evaluation, "Tony, you can't convince people that you're wonderful and that Jesus is wonderful in the same sermon." He said that was a lesson that he learned the rest of his life. And a question we have to ask ourselves, when we do good deeds for the kingdom, are we doing it to bring attention to ourselves or are we doing it for the right motives? Let's look over at John chapters 13, verses 14 through 16. John 13, verses 14 through 16.
14 through 16?
Yes.
"If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you too ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example. You should do just as I have done for you. I tell you the solemn truth, the slave is not greater than his master, nor
okay, now let's look back here. We're just about to close it out. I need to just a minute here. Okay, notice this verse 8. "And though you have not seen him, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory." Peter's telling these people about the joy that they will receive through going through these trials and if they're approved by God. I want to look at that term greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible. That term comes from a combination of several Greek words, laleo, which means to speak, and ek means out, and a is an alpha, privative meaning no. This word literally means not speaking out. It denotes a joy which may be experienced, but is of such a nature as to defy adequate verbal expression. That's the idea there. Our time is up. We have got to verse 10. We'll begin verses 10 through 12 next week is the mystery of salvation. We've got through the first 9 verses. Any comments or anything before we conclude? Our time is up. We'll pick up next week. Appreciate your attention and your comments. Did that record?
Yep, when you're done, just click it. Just hit it again.
So 2-2 and then end.